wanted to call my friends and come and share with us their thoughts as to how they see and analyze the budget, whether as we do our work, do we share the same perspective with the department that they've done everything well, or are there areas of improvement that they will be able to draw attention to? So as we go to our debate on the, I think the 9th, we should be able to raise issues that are of concern both to us but to society as a whole. So I'm not going to decide who starts team and the person. I'm going to leave it to your capable hands to decide that. And that, just, you know, that will allow you to make the presentation, and then probably both of you to make the presentation, and then after that have questions. So that we can then pick up all the issues that the members may want clarity. So we'll just take both presentations following each other, and then we'll then have questions after that. That's all for me. Thank you very much, Chair of the Committee. And good morning to honourable members of the committee and fellow guests. We appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts on the subject before the committee, which is the DFA by the vote. What I am going to do is that maybe let me introduce myself briefly. My name is Amanda Zondi. I head up the Africa and Southern Africa program at the Institute for Global Dialogue. It's an institution that was established in 1994 at a chance meeting between the former President Nelson Mandela and Helmut Kohl, the German Chancellor. And we were established to track global dynamics that have an impact on South Africa and South Africa's foreign policy in general. That's who we are. What I'm going to do is that I'm not going to talk through the budget vote itself, pick up things from the budget vote as you have. But what I decided I would do is that I would reflect on the basis of what I've read in the budget vote, or the things that I think have been with us for a longer period of time. Things that would not enough to address just in the course of this budget year, about things that we need to think very carefully and creatively about in order for South Africa to position itself correctly globally. I would like to begin by pointing you to certain things in the budget board itself that inform the thoughts that you will hear. On page numbers from page 27. On page 27 itself, in the items in the budget summary, I pick up item number 3, which is public diplomacy and protocol. I'm sure you would notice that the estimates there are that for the year 2010 and 2011, there will be a decrease. Expected decrease in expenditure in that area. Please note that. On page 28, the first bullet point, it ends with these words: South Africa will be working towards full implementation of the Regional Indicative Strategic Development Program, which is the development program of SADC, a very progressive program. And secondly, realization of the SADC Regional Economic Integration Agenda, which is the agenda for deeper market integration in the region. Very lofty goals and all of that. Keep that on the back of your mind. And on page 29, the third paragraph, it refers to the fact that South Africa has already released the first draft of the NEPA implementation strategy for South Africa, which it says will guide all stakeholders in the country and will also help mobilize the resources and so on. The next one is the three paragraphs below that, or which begins with the process of engaging the African diaspora. It says it refers to regional integration, regional consultation that is going to be embarked upon. On a global governance, I like the last sentence of the first paragraph, which says, during its membership, 10, South Africa will champion African issues, which means South Africa is going to put African issues on the agenda and going to defend Africa's interests. And then on page 30, I'd like to refer you to the very last paragraph just before the table, the second sentence, which says, following this, the first South African country strategy paper for 2007-2013 was adopted. And lastly, on page 36, under program 3, bullet point 1, public diplomacy liaises with the media, engages with national stakeholders, promotes South African policy and programs domestically and internationally. And that is what I wanted to point out with regard to that. So to keep it in the back of your mind, so that when I come back to them towards the end of the presentation, you will understand why I say the things that I say. Let me just move quickly with the contextual remark, quick one, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. That South Africa has moved from a period of diplomatic normalization, which saw a lot of kind of diplomatic expansion, setting up a large number of diplomatic missions. Actually, a total of 111 were established between 1994 and 2004, and at the same time, we received about 137 foreign missions. Now, in terms of Africa, we established 35 missions, and then just globally, we consolidated special bilaterals, or if you like, elevated bilaterals. That is the bilaterals that we manage through binational commissions. They totaled 34 by 2005, 34 BNCs by 2005. But we also established strategic bilaterals. Will keep global players scattered all over the world, from the EU to Brazil to India, China, Nigeria, and all of that, and a lot of those relationships and a lot of economic value. A second set of remarks is that on the multilateral front, we were also very active in the process of SADC integration, or consolidating SADC integration and consolidation of the SACU itself. Both of them in the same region, same geographical area. I'm going to raise questions later about that. Then active role on the AU transition and institutionalization or setting up of institutions, revitalization of key global South forums, especially NAM, the Bandung agenda, which is now being pursued through the NASP. It's G77 plus China. And with regard to North-South relations, we are also working very hard to build our relationship with the EU and the relationship between the EU and Africa to put the issues of Africa in the G8 agenda. And we were awarded with membership of what is called the G5 or the Outreach 5, that have become almost permanent visitors at the G8 table. That includes China, India, Brazil, and Mexico. And lastly, in terms of global governance, we have also played a very active role in the UN. You would know about the role that we play in the General Assembly, and also in the UN generally, UN Security Council more recently, and we played a particularly prominent role in the UN reform process. And I think the third area is the area of branding and image, which has become very critical in international relations today. Branding and public diplomacy revolving mainly around media relations. And that has been more a recent emphasis in terms of how we manage our foreign policy generally. I'm accepting this thing to say South Africa comes into an international system that is Western dominated, obviously, but it comes at a time when there's a lot of emerging powers that are beginning to really transform power relations in the world. And that creates provides an impetus for a greater emphasis on multilateralism and pursuit for shared value. And I think that that time also raised a lot of questions around the value of the UN itself. Do we need a new organization to drive the global agenda? The need for a new financial architecture to respond to post-Cold War challenges, and a construction of a new developmental agenda, probably around sustainable development, generally. So those are my recommendations. Just the last ones are. South Africa also, because of that confluence of challenges, South Africa gets into the international arena with a reform agenda to try and craft a progressive discourse as an alternative to dominant discourse around globalization. So it crafts its vision as better South Africa, better world, and it positions itself in both its conduct and its positions that it holds at the global level as a non-entrepreneur, a state that wants to behave in an exemplary way and protect certain norms and standards and values rather than pursue its crude interest. And on that basis, it plays more kind of a bridge-building role and seeking consensus and all of that. And another factor that comes into play, if you're looking at the first decade especially, is the difficulty of balancing the foreign policy interests, which are generally very idealistic, and the imperatives of domestic challenges and transformation. Is on that basis. I'd like to pick on more specifically on South Africa's role in the United Nations in order to raise my first point. That role in the United Nations, especially in the General Assembly, seems to me to be an attempt to act as a responsible global citizen. We're promoting non-proliferation of nuclear, played a very critical role at a time when Pakistan had tested a nuclear bomb in 1998, played a very critical role as part of what was called the non Proliferation Action Coalition, the NAC. Secondly, another trend is that we're promoting common positions from the global south on a range of issues, mainly developmental issues, WSSD, MDGs, the agenda of financing for trade, the Monterrey Agenda, but also on the Middle East conflict. The third trend is an attempt to show up the capacity, the integrity of the UN to make sure that the UN remains relevant as a bastion of a developmental agenda. And at the same time, we're pushing for greater representation, some kind of democratization of the UN. And here I'm not referring just to the reform of the UN Security Council, but there's a lot of activities around representation in the secretariat itself, access to procurement and refurbishment of buildings, office space for countries from the south, and all of those. The fourth trend is strengthening the human rights architecture within the UN. Push for the reform, the transition from the Human Rights Commission to the Council, and subsequently worked hard to defend that. The next point is trying to defend the sanctity of the UN and its charter, what it has become known as the rule of law agenda within the UN. That includes defending its financial position, making sure that all countries pay their dues on time, and that those that pay a lot do not use the power of the purse to actually influence the agenda of the organization. and pushed very strongly also for a post-colonial reconstruction at a time when the UN was much more focused on what is called preventative diplomacy, which is peace prevention. We pushed for peace building post-conflict. And lastly, they pushed very strongly up to our chairpersonship of the UN Security Council last month on a structured interface between the UN and regional organizations, believing that the UN can't be everywhere, can't do everything, but it would have to work with regional organizations that happen. That's that work. But what has been controversial is that to some controversy is now our role in the Security Council. I see that role, I see that opportunity as a great opportunity for us to contribute to the maintenance of global peace, and also in contributing to the agenda as to how you actually do that. And I think the immediate challenge we faced was that position required a lot of capacity, a lot more capacity than we actually had, in order to deal with a range of issues that flow in almost every day into the agenda of the UN. The second area of challenge was the controversial issues that were brought to the table. The votes on Myanmar, on Iran, on rape as a weapon of war, on Zimbabwe, and on climate change. They caused controversy because South Africa voted against that. And I think, putting my head on the block, that's a very principled position. Because for example, on Myanmar, ASEAN, which is the regional organization in that region, had advised the UN not to take the issue up yet because they were sending an envoy there. The UN itself was sending an envoy there, an eminent African diplomat, to resolve the issues, and was beginning to make headway. And they felt that a UN security vote could actually destabilize that. On Iran, it was an attempt to defend the integrity of the IAEA, the sole body that is charged with ensuring non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. On rape as weapons of war, the idea was to say we should condemn all political rapes, if you like, all uses of rape as a political weapon, not only in countries in civil war, because that is going to exclude the use of rape in countries like Myanmar itself, but also in areas where the U.S. is occupying. And on Zimbabwe, the idea was that if you go on and let the UN Security Council take over, then there would be no point in having such a mediating on the situation. And then on climate change, it was a matter that is being dealt with in an appropriate body. So generally, my own sense of that was a principled position. They were correct, but they were very difficult. Of course, they led to controversy. And I think the idea was also to protect the integrity of the UN, to promote multilateralism and guard against unilateralism. It was to promote the rule of law. It was also to promote Africa's interests, because in many of those positions, it was actually South Africa bound by collective Africa's interest. Of course, in cases such as Myanmar, there were one or two African countries that changed their position at a point of vote. But I think where the challenge is, and it's a big nemesis for South Africa, is communication. Communication with the public, articulating our position in the world arena. That, for me, was a disaster. It also, this issue and the controversy that resulted from these voting positions, there are serious issues about our inability as South Africa's government to follow the message from the chambers of the UN to the newsrooms and public platforms. We simply found very wanting in terms of taking up the issues. Another controversial issue that I want to point out, to just make the point that I want to make, is Zimbabwe's ever-deepening crisis. And this idea that South Africa is using quiet diplomacy. The point I wanted to make is that if you don't articulate your policy clearly, other actors will define it for you. That is why we have this concept of quiet diplomacy that we don't find in any policy document, but it has become an official description of the South African foreign policy. And if they continue to do, like it happened, push this quiet diplomacy concept, and you do not have a coherent report, a response to it, you are even a bigger mess. And I think that's the problem again. How do you counter that? How do you articulate your own policy? If you don't articulate it, you leave it to the best of those that can to make up their mind on the basis of what the nuances of the actions, the body language, incomplete statements, and things like that. The third issue that has caused a lot of controversy, but very little attention on it, is the negative impact of the expansion of South African cooperation into Africa. That's caused a lot of uneasiness because of certain labor practices. The same uneasiness we have about the expansion of the Chinese companies into our own shore, and fears of sub-imperialism. Why this issue, I think, is about regulation and guidance and putting the laws in place, but I think it's also about how we articulate ourselves and how we engage each other internally, but how we engage with other countries in Africa. Because one of the challenges, for example, in Tanzania, was that there were serious challenges with the labor practices by the Shoprite Checkers company, but there was no clear word from the South African government, no attempt to engage them, at least to understand the problem, and also to work out how you deal with them. So if we don't communicate this, if we don't engage, activities of companies will continue to define who we are and how our interests are, no matter what we say about our view of Africa and what we want to do in Africa. So then I think then the problem is a big problem, bigger than many other issues in my view, is that of public diplomacy. I think the UN Security Council was a PR disaster in my view, and I think it's an epitome of a deeper problem that we have in terms of how we articulate and defend our foreign policy. I think that's a big problem. So the politicians and policies can be principled, but if they are not well and proactively articulated, for me, it doesn't take us anywhere. I think generally the South African government has a big problem with articulating its own position, both to citizens and also to outside audiences. And I think that's the challenge we have to grapple with. That's what I think the Department of Foreign Affairs should be pressured to work out what are they doing with regard to that. Because in my view, in global debate generally, especially now in the post-Cold War era, the correctness of position depends on public perceptions as well. If you aren't able to shape, influence public perception, positions can be correct, but what you will get in the media, what you will get out there, it will be what public perceptions are made there. Just to mention on what I think is the basic problem is, I think the basic problem is that, and I've asked a couple of people at the Department of Foreign Affairs, what do you mean by public diplomacy? When you say you have public diplomacy, what do you mean? Because we had the communications department before, a section before, now we call it public diplomacy. It seems to me that we always had a media liaison office that was simply renamed public diplomacy without changing the modus operandi, without changing the agenda, without developing strategies, without developing, clearing ourselves as to what we mean by the public diplomacy. In the thing that I've read for you on public diplomacy, they say it's the public diplomacy section liaises with the media, engages with national stakeholders, and promotes South Africa's policies and programs domestically and internationally. The big question is how. I can affirm the first element, which is liaising with the media, releasing face statements every time there's a big event, but engaging with national stakeholders, engaging business, engaging civil society, engaging political parties, engaging parliament, I'm not quite sure if that is what to do. So in my sense, it tends to be media liaison. So it's print statements, to inform and alert. So the purpose is information rather than articulation of policies and positions or engagement. The target is the media rather than citizens and opinion makers. Yet the latter are very, very critical in my view. It tends to be a small element of a huge organization. The public diplomacy section of the department is a very small unit. I don't think they number more than 10. But I think it is much more crucial than that, because for me, the size of the section indicates the value that the FA attaches to it currently. Yet it has proven to be our biggest challenge every time. It's not how good our policies are, that area has been worked out and covered very well, but how we articulate those policies and defend them in the marketplace of ideas. It tends to be written statements and therefore monologues rather than dialogue and engagement. What I really often find is that the person in charge of public diplomacy will release a statement, the minister so-and-so is going to be there, talk about this and that, push off. And there's no engagement. Not even in the course of releasing the statement are you given an opportunity to even ask questions. And another avenue that is used is the website. Website is brilliant, and it's also very, very, I mean, it has improved over a long period of time. It's one of the most informative websites. But the serious challenges around who accesses the website. But also it's the fact that there's no space for comment on it. So it's a read-only avenue. So it's for you to listen to what the department is saying, not to engage what the department is also saying. I always wonder, I haven't found an answer to this question, that if they have a public diplomacy strategy, at least written, that this is what we're setting out to do. Because once we have that, then we're able to engage it and point out where maybe the challenges, basic challenges may be. And what is the plan? I often find that it's all usually clustered together with protocol. So that you find that protocol tends to overshadow the public diplomacy element of it. If it had a public diplomacy strategy, it would be able to anticipate areas of difficulty, in my view, and proactively engage on them, be it on Zimbabwe, be it on the EU, EPAS thing, and all of those things. So we don't have the ministers themselves doing what the department could actually able to do. A proper communication expert doing the communication. Because sometimes when we're not communication expert and we're communicating, we miscommunicate. And that leads to all sorts of challenges. I think also if it did, you would see it in a very coherent, a very coordinated moves by envoys that we have all over the world, diplomats I mean, armed with appropriate information to respond to all sorts of issues from wherever they are. The British do this very, very well. When there's a big issue with the British at a global level, you can ask any diplomat anywhere in the world. They will be able to defend their country position much easier. Just quickly, there's a number of other issues. I mean, issues around training, issues around how we use events as opportunities to communicate and sell South Africa in a very structured way, rather than using events simply to what the public diplomacy section of the budget vote and even in their strategic plan talks about them assisting, organizing, and holding press conferences. I think that is good, that is fine, but you need a little much more subtle stuff than that. How do you use this event to prop up South Africa's image and to jack up South Africa's position globally, to promote South Africa's foreign policy? What other informal avenues are we using for this kind of thing? And I referred to the portion of the budget summary, the portion on public diplomacy. They seem to be indicating that they're going to be less and less expenditure on public diplomacy, and I would have argued for an increase in public diplomacy, because you decrease when you actually are doing well in that area. But also even the current budget, how do we disaggregate it? Because they're lumped together with protocol. So which one is the public diplomacy, and what exactly is public diplomacy meant to do, and what the others are? What is being spent, actually, on building the communications infrastructure, given the fact that communication has become a very critical site of contestation in international relations? Information aid. Those that take it seriously really gain a lot of mileage in terms of international relations. And I think foreign policy thrives on its ability to succeed in the marketplace of ideas. And I think a major element of the public diplomacy is how the department interacts with opinion makers, with interlocutors, with purveyors of information, and all of those intermediaries, because they are critical in informing public perception. But that we have not seen in a serious way. We're talking about analysts, columnists, NGOs, prominent persons. We saw that if you don't do that, it can be damaging. If you look at Bishop Tutu's statements on Myanmar, and certain incorrect facts in his statement, it points to the fact that we're not engaging people that matter in terms of shaping public opinion, at least in order to explain what we are actually doing and what we're planning. There is a small process, almost informal, that is driven by a unit called CRAU within the Foreign Affairs. I think it stands for Policy and Research Unit. It's in the ministry, where they're interfacing with research organizations, mainly and think tanks, to debate some of their policy positions and all of that. But what we often find is that it's only just the staff from CRAU who are actually doing a lot of logistical work, and then a full house of think tanks and analysts and intellectuals, but no one from DFA proper. They raise questions as to whether they take seriously the responsibility to engage this sector. But these activities are not necessarily a budget item. And as a result, it's meant to be held at the offices itself, so they you cannot maximize it in any way. So there are no clear terms of reference, and as I said, DFA participation is an area of concern. There has been an improvement during the course of South Africa's term in the UN Security Council. There has been much more engagement with the intellectuals. At least there was one big meeting with intellectuals, and then there was a meeting with media, intellectuals and media, actually, and there have been regular media briefings. But one wonders what will happen once our term lapses. Maybe all of that work could lapse back as well. Because again, it's not, it doesn't seem budgeted for, in my view. In terms of public engagement, you know, this idea of, in the spirit of Batufilo, Izimbizo. Almost every department has Izimbizo. And DSA had one Izimbizo in 2005. That was during the UN reform, at least as far as I know, I stand to be corrected. But as far as I remember, that is the only one. Why? And what's the plan? I haven't seen in the budget item their intention to engage the citizens, because I really truly feel that the citizens deserve to hear what DFA is doing. Ask questions about what we're doing in the foreign land. Otherwise, how else will we deal with the perception that the South African government is focusing too much on Africa and the world and less on domestic affairs if we don't engage them? So what item in the budget provides for this public engagement? I haven't seen. There are also issues of coordination. I'm just going to run through this very quickly. Coordination between economic and political diplomacy. Well, there's certain challenges that we face because DTI and DFA don't actually coordinate their work as well as they should, even on issues like SADC integration. This poor coordination was pointed out in the 10-year review, the presidency's 10-year review, and has also just been pointed out in the 15-year review that was concluded about a month ago. And it refers to lack of coherence between the work between the two departments. I think the challenge is the fact that, you know, there's not enough coordinated training of South African diplomats in economic diplomacy, but also of the DTI officials in certain basics of our own political diplomacy generally. So there's a kind of a disjuncture in the two. Yes, they are meant to appear very coherent and very integrated when they interface with China or with other external actors. So I think this requires a very structured focus from DSA as a lead department in this area on how they would engage DTI and how they would improve economic diplomacy within it. And an area that is very little attention is the fact that, you know, it's a phenomenon of the post-1970s period, international relations, that has been an increasing role by sub-national entities, like the cities, like provinces, like states in some countries. In international relations, they are forming agreements, they are establishing relationships, they are signing and twinning agreements, taking very critical decisions, sometimes that have an impact on national agenda and national priorities. Sometimes can even compromise national security. South Africa has not been an exception in this. Especially after 1994, there's been a dramatic increase in international trips by provinces and by cities. And sometimes it undermines South Africa's national agenda. They speak in different words, they encroach into each other's territories, they actually have been compete for certain delegations. There was a story that we had of a delegation that went to Japan, and it was different, two different provinces from South Africa. They were competing for a relationship with a province in Japan. And they had to jostle each other, outbox each other. In some cases, the agenda is not deep. It's simply to go and see what is happening in Japan and observe. It costs study trips. And sometimes study trips are taken year after year to the same provinces and same countries to study opportunities. There's a possibility of dislocating the national agenda. Some people call it political tourism. And the DSA has indeed begun to respond to this, but only recently after the cabinet, the junta, raised issues, problems around this thing. Second time in a row. But after the second time, the DSA began to respond. It had a study, an internal study, to say what is the problem. Well, good. And then it had workshops with the provinces. Yes, that is good. But is that enough to ensure that there's a coordinated international relations in South Africa? DFA tends to want to limit itself to ensuring that there's proper protocol and proper etiquette. But I think it must be deeper than that.
Well, nice.
So my question then to the committee, and maybe you can pass it on to DFA, is what item in the budget is meant to address this challenge? I haven't seen. South Africa in Africa, we would know, we refer to South Africa saying they want to play, to champion African issues and all that, but we know that South Africa's leadership in Africa is increasingly being challenged as our moral authority wanes. It was easier in the beginning because of the miracle of transition, new baby on the block, everybody was kind towards us. But now we have to defend our interests much more robustly. So we can never ever take for granted our leadership role. So what are we doing to play a much bolder role than we actually play? Nepal is falling apart. It is almost collapsing. And part of the problem is that the people that we have deployed there, we withdrew them so that other African countries can also be part of it. But they do not have the same passion. As a result, the thing is falling apart. Because you don't want to play a hegemonic role.
Yeah.
Should we continue to invest in SADC if we have our eyes on SADC? Because SADC is going to become a customs union by 2012, according to plan. And you can't be a member of two customs unions. Is it prudent for us to invest on both sides? That's a question we need to raise. Empty offices abroad. What do I mean? One of the major contradictions of South Africa's very active IR is the failure to staff the positions that are set aside for us in the AUN, in the AU, and in the SADC. We're not filling up the positions that we have. And we do that at our peril, I think, because we lose opportunities to advance our interests within these organizations, and also it leaves us with a lack of commitment to change.
Or general, but from where?
Yeah. And one critical example is that some of the countries, you know, lament the fact that we didn't put somebody forward as a new chair for the AU Commission. As a result, the Southern African region lost the quota, but it was supposed to move to Southern Africa. In the end, this moved to Gabon in Central Africa. Somebody that nobody knows. Somebody that does not have a very good record in running organization ended up being an AU Commission. And some of the people blame South Africa for not taking the role that they were supposed to play, and allow Swaziland to put forward somebody who is at the level of a director to be a chair of the commission, which is a head of state level position. One lesson is that when we deployed very senior officials at NAPAD and SADC, especially in the period between 2000 and 2004, our interests were secured very well. We were able to move NAPAD in a very clear way. We were able to get SADC for the first time to transform and go through the transition, reform, completely restructure, and also to adopt for the first time a development policy. But once the development policy was adopted, we withdrew or the term lapsed, but it didn't replace. And as a result, things again slowed down. Right now, the SADC Secretariat has a number of vacancies. There's a lot of people that are acting, and somebody was saying SADC is no longer an interstate. SADC Secretariat is no longer a political organization. It is Hollywood, because many people are acting. There's an acting director there, acting this. So, if we do not deliberately put people in the correct position, we may not actually secure the things that we work hard to build. Because we don't build, and after building, let others prop it up, unless you are sure that they have the same interest. And I'm going to skip this. It's about, you know, the capacity within DFA, and go to this web, which is my last one. South Africa is a development partner. One of the things that come out of this is how much we are spending through the Renaissance Fund, African Renaissance Fund and others, to advance really progressive agenda in Africa. But I want to make this point, that it's a lesson that we've learned over centuries, is that donors have interests too. They're not just driven by values alone, but they also do have interests. Your aid must be tied to a particular agenda, must advance a particular agenda. It must not be your contribution for the sake of it. South Africa contributes very significantly to the AU budget, but it's very cautious in taking positions that it needs to take, both in terms of staffing positions, but in terms also of policy positions at the AU. As a result, a country like Libya, a country like Gabon, or maybe Gabon is much more proper, a country like Gabon, that would not pay its dues for 4 years, would take a much more active position in the AU than South Africa, which pays over and above its calculated dues. South Africa was very cautious and very well-mannered, if you like. So we're providing all sorts of support, but I'm not sure if we're using this as a strategic leverage. If we are ensuring that there is a return for the taxpayers' investment, are we being too naive? I don't know. Should we be going much, much more robust, much more aggressive? Maybe. In conclusion, let me just make this very quick point. So, our active IR has posed new challenges for us, and I think in order to build on the success we've made and deal with the weaknesses, we need to show much more energy than we actually currently show. And I think we need to balance normal diplomatic activities with new dimensions of public and economic diplomacy in the area of foreign policy. And I think having making sure that we establish embassies everywhere is good to make sure our presence is everywhere. But I think much more importantly, our presence will be felt when we populate international organizations that we are asked to populate. And secondly, when we are present actively in the marketplace of ideas through public diplomacy. Let me raise my case there. Thank you.
There's no money there.
I have a comrade. Don't want to come to net wide.
I think I am. That's their problem. Babugana bought
one. They say, no, this one come make it. He has never been.
I think
what we need to do is to argue for the second man, also from the government, and pay them an allowance. Because the main problem there has been the people don't want to go because there's no money.
Okay, Tim, take us through. I think the point that Honorable Holmes has raised must be taken up in the debate because I think it has been a very important issue. In fact, if members remember that we were told at some point by the department that they are working on the bodies on that particular issue. So it's not outside the presentation. In fact, I think we should pick it up when we raise issues.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, Dr. Zondi. Let me first say that I'm delighted not to be addressing the either the Home Affairs Committee, Sports Committee, or Communications Committee. It's good to be amongst friends. Thanks for the opportunity. Now, I know time is short, so given that Dr. Donnie placed much of what I'd like to say in context, please excuse me whipping through these slides rather quickly. There is a page missing, and thank you very much to the support staff for reproducing this. There's a page missing near the back, which is some of the critical questions I want to ask. So please don't think that I've just jumped in and asked the questions, but I will speak to them now. Okay, thank you again for the invitation, and I'll go through this very, very quickly indeed, and perhaps we could get to some of the questions that perplex me and perhaps may perplex you too. The brief that we were given was to look at budget, and to perhaps examine whether or not it's in alignment with the strategic objectives or the stated objectives of the department. And therefore, it's quite a tight formulation for us. Given that the context, the global context, has been sketched out very, very well indeed, very masterfully, we'll speak to some institutional issues, I think, more particularly. Honourable members, you are very familiar. You've had the briefing from the Director General, very familiar with the structure of the DFA program, or its constituent programs 1, 2, 3, and 4. They don't need to be reiterated by me, and we can move through them quite quickly. But they're all there for your consumption. Could I just say, right at the beginning, that the opinion of SIAE, the South African Institute of International Affairs, is that the Department of Foreign Affairs is currently in better shape than it has been for a long time. To us, the Department appears to have greater strategic alignment than it has had for quite some time. It appears that the budget is largely aligned to the stated objectives of the Department. It appears to us that the strategic plan of the department is largely aligned to the budget and indeed to the annual report. We obviously have to wait and see what the annual report says when it comes out in September of this year. It also looks to us as if the department has achieved a degree of stability, of institutional stability, of institutional and programmatic clarity, and indeed that the department is looking stronger in its personnel cohort and more transformed than it has since 1994. So from the SIAE perspective, the Department of Foreign Affairs deserves congratulations. It looks to us as if it's in pretty good hands. It looks a better place to work. It looks more effective. It looks more efficient. And what we'd like to also comment on is that 2 years ago we made a presentation to the committee and pointed out some of the issues that we felt could be looked at profitably and constructively. We are delighted to see those recommendations finding their way into the strategic plan. And I'd like to congratulate the committee on its work in ensuring that those issues that we raised do find expression with the department at the executive level and have found expression in the strategic plan. The challenge now is turning the plan into reality. Honourable members, you're all familiar with the general outline of the budget, that the budget, in fact, in terms of the NTEF, is slightly higher for 2009 and 2010 for a number of reasons. The new presidency, we have the building of the new head office, there's some infrastructural program, some IT program, and did I mention the new presidency? Yes, I probably did as well. There's been some budgeting for air transport as well. So the program actually peaks, or at least in terms of the MTF, next year, and drops, or is projected to drop slightly, 2010-2011. One central point I'd like to make for consideration of the committee or for the committee is the ever-increasing complexity of the activities of the department. They are becoming more detailed, more complex, and more challenging. So as much as I have, or we have congratulated on the department on its coherence, its structure, its clarity, its consistency, and its alignment, the programmatic challenges facing the department are becoming more complex and more numerous, if I may say. These are the KPAs as set out by the department itself, and they are quite numerous. But if we go to the breakdown of objectives, deliverables, indicators, and targets, honorable members, that are all set out in the strategic plan. If we look at program two in particular, our foreign relations, which is a, let's face it, this is our public face, this is the meat and potatoes of our foreign policy. If you look at the objectives that we have set, or the department set, it is 42 key objectives. It has set itself in this MTF. It is 75 deliverables. And if you look at the indicators, they run into 89, 83, and 79. It is a very, very challenging program. Now, that has to raise questions about capacity, achievability, oversight, measurement, and variance. Now, admittedly, some of the language that is used in the strategic plan is quite general. Enhance, develop, strengthen. This is fine. This is an activity. But at a certain point, honorable members, the department has to be held to account in terms of what it actually has achieved. And we've been through this before. It is quite difficult for this department insofar as it's not housing. We don't measure houses or hospitals or patients or education. It's not as tangible. Sure, we can measure chancery, which we do. We can measure personnel. But with foreign affairs, it's rather difficult to measure influence or impact. So we have to find some benchmarks for that. And I would submit to the committee, if I may be so bold, that that demands greater engagement from the committee in situ. It means going to the department, perhaps more frequently, with more detailed interrogation of the department and its achievable or non-achievable. It reads very, very well, but requires much deeper engagement. We can all measure housing delivery. It is very difficult to measure influence. It's a point that Dr. Zondi made in terms of our public relations, which we have to work on, and I concur with that. Honourable members, I'm not going to go through the graphs. I thank my colleagues at SIA for helping me with these graphs, but the trends are fairly clear. The upward trend with regard to our programme to foreign relations, but in fact, look at the peak in terms of the blue line administration. We peak in 2009-2010, and the forecast is that our expenditure on administration should drop somewhat thereafter. These graphics are easy for you to read, and they do not require any further elaboration from me. But I suppose one of the key questions I wanted to ask of this committee, or suggest to this committee, and it's a controversial topic, but it is worth asking. Is the DFA strategic plan and budget aligned with South Africa's interests? Now, those interests we have attempted to define since 1990. 1992, 1993, the critical document that set out our foreign policy principles. 1994, the review of 1996, the launching of NEPAD 2001, etc., etc. It is not that our interests are contested. Some of them are contested. But does the plan achieve or help to achieve, or is it aligned with our stated interests and objectives? Well, in terms, if strengthening or growing or enhancing the African agenda is a key element to our foreign policy engagement, and that consistently is stated as the case, then it would seem that the department is, in fact, following through on that key objective. If we look at simply at diplomatic missions opened and our objectives of opening a mission in every African country. We originally set the target of 2008, you will recall, and we've fallen behind a little bit on that. And honourable members, we have to, you perhaps know better than I, but if you speak to the DSA as to why we've fallen behind, they will comment that Treasury has not given the department the sufficient resources to open. And the question would be, why? Other interpretations of capacity, and other interpretations have been, we have to prioritise other issues. But it's accepted that we should have a mission, or rather an embassy, a mission abroad in Africa, in every African country by 2010 and 2011. So there is fairly clear alignment there. We have also stated that Asia and the Gulf, Middle East, we noticed noted the President's visit to Qatar yesterday, and the opening of the Oryx GTL plant, that this would be a focus of growth for us, China, the Middle East, the Gulf. If you look at our projected missions as well, from even 2004 to where we should be in 2010, it looks like the department is on track to achieve its objectives as well. The Americas and Europe remain static. Stagnant is the wrong word, but obviously very clearly established. The objective of strengthening bilateral relations in Africa is supported in the budget. It is supported at the bilateral level. There is very clear evidence that we are spending money, as we said we would, to strengthen our diplomatic representation in Africa, and it is consistent. There is no blip, there's no inconsistency from what we can see as well. Honourable members, that chart is there for you. That one needs a little bit of explanation. The blue line is absolute expenditure. The red columns are relative, or the growth, the annual growth in expenditure. So the rate of growth will drop from 2008, 2009, but the absolute expenditure, of course, will continue to increase. All right. The big question I wanted to ask you, having said all that, is, well, not who we benchmarking ourselves against, but I think a bit of a sober reality check for us. I think stand back and say, look, yeah, we are part of the Outreach 5. We are highly regarded with the Outreach 5. I was in Mexico in an Outreach 5 meeting this year, and we are very highly regarded indeed. We are regarded as a key South interlocutor and obviously a key African interlocutor. But honourable members, please note that in terms of the growth of us as a country, our GDP, if we're benchmarking ourselves, which we don't necessarily do, against the Outreach 5, for example, we're not doing as well as the Outreach 5. Just let me leave that question and issue with you, because when we look at the longer term foreign policy engagement of our country, the big question for us is, we have strategic interests, we have diplomatic interests, we have political interests, we have north-south, south-south interests, but we have some key economic interests that our foreign policy has to engage with and on to get that growth trajectory higher than it has been recently. Let me make the obvious point to you, but it requires stating that our key trading partners remain the West, or let me rephrase that. Our traditional trading partners, and increasingly Asia. The encouraging point is the growth in our exports, which favours us, into the SADC region, which you'll see 2004, 2007. But overwhelmingly, our trading partners or our export partners remain the EU, Asia, and North America. There is growth in SADC, and there's encouraging growth in China. The question, all I'm asking, honourable members, is to be cognizant of the global dynamics of South Africa's interest, economic interest, trade interest, as well as political and diplomatic and strategic interest as well. These charts, please go through at your own leisure. I think it just reinforces the point that if we speak about the emphasis on economic diplomacy, then we have to ask how effective our department is in driving and growing our economic clout, and how effective our missions are in facilitating economic growth, and how well equipped our diplomats are to achieve those objectives. How clear are they? How well trained are they? How skilled are they as well? honourable members be aware of the trade imbalance that we have with certain regions too? That would be awfully helpful if we can address that trade imbalance. Okay, let me push on. Does the department have the capacity to achieve its complex and expanding objectives and commitments? A key question. We can set out a strategic plan that is elegant, is consistent, is well written, but can we achieve those complex objectives? And so I would in a sense please that Dr. Gandhi did not go into this detail because we did. And we were looking at this difficult question that the department has faced about its vacancy rate. You remember 2 years ago, I think we had an overall vacancy rate of about 34%. So we wanted to sketch what are the trends. It's one thing to say what's the percentage, but what are the trends? And I am very, very pleased to say that according to the data to hand that we've collated, collaborated, and checked, the trends are encouraging. The vacancy rates are dropping, and they're dropping quite markedly, with a couple of blips and blasters. This is true. But the trend from 2003, when we start to see 2003, 2004, 2005, when we see consistency, may I say leadership, good management, good vision, good strategic plans, and adequate funding, and good plans in place to recruit new staff, and to stop the hemorrhaging of staff, and the very high turnover of staff, we start to see some very encouraging developments at all levels. And the department's to be congratulated on that, I think. Indeed, if we look at critical occupations, the pattern is quite encouraging, yet, at the if you look in the diplomatic corps, if you look at the total overall picture, it's still not where we'd like it to be, because the total overall picture of vacancy in critical occupations is still hovering above the 50% mark. Chair and honourable members, we have to bring that down. We and the department has a plan. This is not a criticism, but it is a critical issue if we are to achieve this complex set of objectives we've set ourselves. Honourable members, we've broken it down into program vacancies as well for you. I don't need to go through that. Please do go through that at your own time. The flash drive is here. We can load it up for you as well. One of the critical areas for us is program two, foreign affairs, foreign relations, but it's not the only critical program. If we don't have infrastructure, if we don't have management and ICT, we can't achieve our objectives. On transformation. Now again, the picture is not as satisfactory as we would like it to be. It is not as satisfactory as it must be and could be and should be. But the pattern is improving. There is no doubt, as far as I can see, the pattern is improving. The percentage of males, which is less important perhaps than the percentage of the increase in females, has come down, and therefore the percentage of females has gone up. It still hovers far too high, one would argue, at the top management level and the senior management level. Honourable members, look at the two top lines, if I may, the blue and the red lines. We're still in a position where males occupy something like 70% of the senior positions in the department. It's still skewed. Conversely, there is some slow, painfully slow, improvement, and perhaps inadequate improvement, in the representation of women in certain occupation bands within the DFA. In the top management position, we have seen some improvement. And in the senior management position, it has been very slow and it is hovering just above the 30% level now. The professionally qualified and mid-management were just below 50%. So on that criterion, we're getting close to perhaps where we'd like to be as a country and as a department, but we still have a lot more work to do. We have broken this down into so-called, into race categories and criteria as well. Into the respective bands, and you will see there an increasing pattern of African representation, a decreasing pattern of white representation, a slightly decreasing pro rata representation of Indian people, and a fairly consistent band of colored representation too. All right, good. I wanted to skip to some specific questions. I know we're very, very short of time, and I do hope that the one page that's missing is on this presentation, because it's missing out of your pack here. I ask these questions because I don't have an answer, and I know that you had an opportunity to interrogate the Director General about this question of these particular issues, why the $100 million requested for organizational strengthening was not accepted by Treasury, nor indeed the amount requested for the strengthening of missions in Asia and Africa, nor indeed for our chairing of SADC, which commences in August. I have tried to fish out answers. You may well have an answer for that. The answer that I got from DFA was, it's a constant struggle with Treasury. It's not that the budget is declining. It's not. It's increasing reasonably healthily. I just can't see why in a critical area of organizational strengthening that would be refused as well. Ah, good. This is the page that's missing from your presentation, so my apologies. But it does ask some pretty critical questions, and they do reinforce my colleague's questions as well to some degree. Now, we know that the Foreign Service Institute is being amalgamated, or has, or is in the process of being amalgamated with the Policy Research and Advisory Unit. That's a fait accompli. I have to say, honourable members, that from the perspective of a think tank, there appears to have been too much chopping, changing, flux, uncertainty, incoherence, inconsistency with both the leadership of the FSI, the activities of the FSI, the content in the FSI, and in fact what it's supposed to be doing. And that goes to language skills, it goes to a host of things. It is conceivable that the PRAU, or the merging of these two entities, so to speak, under one roof, may well strengthen the success of this unit. However, do we yet know, have we had an opportunity, has this committee had an opportunity to evaluate the PRAU? We know that there was a master's degree from UNISA being offered on economic diplomacy, etc., etc. I heard yesterday that that degree has either not been incorporated, or has collapsed, or is not being carried through. I stand corrected if that's not true. But honourable members, this is our nursery, and this is the brains trust, and this is the brains of our department. This is the brains of our diplomacy. This is where we learn our statecraft. This is where we learn to out-negotiate the EU, if we can ever do that. This is where we learn to cooperate and collaborate on South-South issues. This should be where our highest caliber officials are taught, inducted with the highest caliber skills. This should be a unit that is world-class. And has the committee had an opportunity to assess that? Is it independently evaluated? Is it accredited? It was going for accreditation, I know. Is this the equivalent of an MBA class? What is it? Is it a master's class? Is it for people that need to be re-educated? What is it? We need to achieve in the first instance, honourable members, a degree of institutional continuity around this level. And then I would ask the question, do our diplomats have the requisite policy skills and understanding to strengthen South Africa's economic diplomacy? Credit to the department has identified this as a key area that needs to be addressed and is addressing it. I had understood that it would be addressed from this unit, so the prior question about evaluating this unit still needs to be asked. And just a simple one. Honourable members, I'm afraid I can only give you what I've done in terms of phone calls and research. But for example, when we opened our chancery in Berlin, a criticism of our diplomats was that there was no South African diplomat in Berlin that could speak German in any sense fluently. I would ask you, honourable members, how many members of our diplomatic staff speak Mandarin? We know the Australian Prime Minister does. How many of our staff speak Mandarin? How many speak Arabic, Kiswahili, Spanish, French? I know there's an emphasis. Portuguese. If we're going to be part of IFSA, we have to speak Portuguese. Urdu. Mua, help me with that. But what, do we have the requisite language skills to compete and to make ourselves heard as diplomats? Oh, sorry, there's two slides missing. Honourable members, the department says that it's going to assist with regional harmonisation, RECs, the free trade area, free trade agreement, etc. I would submit to you, and it reinforces the point made by our colleague, there needs to be a lot more work done between the coordination between DTI and DFA, and I would also submit to you that some of the benchmark timelines that we have set ourselves, and in fact that the department has stated in its documentation, remain optimistic. I doubt that we are going to see a successful FTA. I doubt if our EPAs are going to be successfully negotiated. I'm not even sure what we're going to do with the WTO. SACU itself is under stress, and there's a potential for fragmentation in the region. We have differentiated interests in the region that DFA, I would submit to you, has to apply its mind to in collaboration with DTI. We won't achieve it otherwise. It's interesting how our colleagues spoke about, are we achieving our objectives with NEPAD? There are people in the international community who are not Afro-pessimists. They've worked with us for a long time, who are saying NEPAD's dead. I don't believe it's dead, but I believe we have work to do. If that is the keystone, if that's the blueprint of our African engagement and our global engagement, we have work to do to get it asserted onto the agenda to show tangible success, and the key interlocutors for that are our diplomats. Honourable members, could I ask one more question of you as well? It is one thing to have bricks and mortar in Burkina Faso, Gabon, and Niger, you name it. I'm using countries in West Africa, which is not a traditional homeland of our interest, but it's one that's become increasingly important. Have we yet evaluated what our new missions are doing? Have we really identified what are, besides visas, consular services, are they really promoting economic interests? If it's an area of post-conflict reconstruction, such as Monrovia, Liberia, we have every justification to be there. But what are we actually doing? It's one thing to have bricks and mortar, to have our flag, to have discussions, but what really are we doing? If it's post-conflict reconstruction, what intelligence are we gathering? Have we got early warning? What are our military attachés doing? How are we feeding that information back in? So I support completely the objective of having a mission in every African country. I think it's crucial. But as a committee, I would ask you please to consider very seriously evaluating what our new missions are doing in Africa, what role they are playing as well. Okay. Final big question, honourable members. There's not much found in the strategic plan about big issues that are going to impact on Africa. And yet you find them in the EU-Africa Strategic Partnership Agreement and the plan, such as climate change, energy security, water stress, and migration, which is going to be propelled by all these things. Africa is the fastest urbanizing continent on Earth. It is also the continent that will be most affected by climate change. We're starting to see it. This is going to have a profound effect on all our programs, not just what we do as Great or Grand Inga. And I would like to see, or perhaps the committee could find out, what's the department's strategic view? What's its vision in terms of tackling or looking for or capacity building or leading on these very, very big strategic challenges to the continent and our role in it? Honourable members, I will understand if you tell me this is off base and has no role in this briefing at all. But let me just try and raise it, because I think it's a strategic issue for us as a country, for this committee and for the department. Now, it is clearly nothing that's been addressed in the strategic plan, but it has to form part of our strategic thinking. If for no other reason than that this president, President Mbeki, has been a foreign policy president. He is, by dint of personality and by experience and by effort, and by intelligence and interest, a foreign policy president. He's led NEPAD. He's put Africa onto the agenda of the G8. He's galvanized the AU. We house the Pan-African Parliament. We played a strategic role at the UN Security Council in April in terms of the peace and security etc. There has been no African leader in history that can match the achievements of President Mbeki. Not only by dint of personality, institutionally. He has built institutions in South Africa and helped to galvanize them continentally. The question I would raise for you is, are there questions we should be asking then about succession planning? How will a new president, irrespective of who this president is going to be, can we expect a degree of institutional flux or continuity? What's the department planning for? New ministers, we may have a new minister, and we may have a new DG. We may not, but we have to bear that in mind. By April next year, May, we may know this. We may be confronting a different configuration with the DFA. Will our priorities change as a department? Will there be a different relationship between the presidency, the policy unit, and the Department of Foreign Affairs? And finally, honourable members, will there be a new relationship, this is perhaps a new space and the opportunity, for on foreign affairs between the presidency, the Department of Foreign Affairs, and Parliament? Will there be a different role? I don't know. I leave that with you. It's not an insubstantial question. In the Outreach 5, the Sherpa for South Africa, I think, is Advocate Mbumbi. It's in the presidency. It doesn't, the Sherpa for the Outreach 5 is not in the Department of Foreign Affairs. I stand corrected on that point. But it is an institutional question in terms of continuity and change. If we want to institution ourselves as part of the G13, we have to have some continuity and we have to prepare for this as well. That's all I have to say this morning, this afternoon. Thank you.
I must thank the presenters, Dr. Zoldy and Tim. It's always easy when you are committed to see the presentation, but when you ask questions, that goes to the heart of your oversight work, it becomes a little bit complex and difficult. And I think members will then have to, as they deal with those questions in their mind, and also provide answers to some of the questions. Because these questions may not necessarily all be answered by the department, but they may go into how do we, as members of this committee, raise these issues and keep check on these issues, how do we follow those issues as they impact on our daily execution of work. And therefore, I hope that in our engagement, we'll keep these questions at the back of our mind and see how we interact with them as we move on. Honorable Holmes.
Thank you, Chairperson, and colleagues and the panelists. Most of the concerns and questions raised and expressed by the two panelists have been raised by this committee on a number of occasions, even when this committee visited the Department of Foreign Affairs. So I'm happy that there has been an analysis done by outside institutions who are beginning to see, to say, we see a little bit of change from what Foreign Affairs Department has been in previous years. But the area which I want to focus on is the lack of coordination. This word lack of coordination seems to be affecting almost all our state departments. We noticed this in the security cluster. We also saw this in King's Commission. We also see this recently in the Kapembe Commission, saying people are putting their own personal interest ahead of working hand in hand. What I would like to say, perhaps suggest into this committee, is that this committee has done well considering that the strategic interest policy, particularly of foreign affairs, is based at the president, whether you like it or not, just like that. But what we should do is to begin to engage the DG of Foreign Affairs. I know maybe they will say sensitive, they are scared, people look after their bases and so on. But this committee should seriously ask the Department of Foreign Affairs and say, man, this committee is responsible for the accounting for the foreign policy. Therefore, everyone who deals with that should account to it. We should not mince our words on that. But perhaps because we respect the presidency and so on, we should request President Mbeki that when the DG of Foreign Affairs or Minister of Foreign Affairs comes to brief us, he should send his DG or at least the Minister of State in his office. Because there are lots and millions of friends which are not perhaps reflected there, but which are run on the other side. So who is accountable? Who is he accounting to? So there are certain decisions which have been taken, and I don't want to go back to that. But as this committee, we have been working together, mm-hmm. and we raised those questions to the Foreign Affairs positions in the UN and so on in many other areas. And I think there is still a need to negotiate with that office if it has not been done, the President. Question of legacy of our foreign policy, which we have developed over the years. There is no way you cannot change it overnight, even if somebody who knows nothing about diplomacy becomes president tomorrow. He or she will have to follow this, the foreign policy which we have adopted. But what we need to do would be to review that policy and synchronize it and focus more on what interests South Africa. Because that's a big question. Foreign Affairs policy is about what is your interest in opening an office in UN or in country X. So I would suggest that, firstly, I join the chairperson in thanking you for your presentation, but be informed that collectively in this committee, almost every point you have raised, you have attended to. The progress you see there is because of the pressure from this committee. But the main worry for us is two foreign departments, presidency and Gosas and Asuna. Thank you. How do you coordinate that? Not say it's wrong, but we need to coordinate. And we ask questions, somebody must answer this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, I should also go back to the presenters to give them the accolades. And I think they set the proper tone for what I call a proper positive attitude in terms of introspection without being held captive by ideological pockets, but having in mind the interests of the country at large, which is, I think, very, very serious and critical for many countries in this continent of ours, where ideology seems to supersede citizens' interests and the well-being of the continent itself to reach into the far future, hence the many hiccups. But once we begin to prepare ourselves internally for positive introspection, I think we're heading places, and you have certainly done that. What I would like to know is also to find out exactly what balance should be kept between DFA, DTI, and I want to add Home Affairs Department, because there seems to be a lot of disjuncture in terms of modus operandi of these two entities, which I regard as very critical in terms of your protecting yourself to the world at large or the global village, so to say. So that I would like to know exactly what balance. And I know there's no handbook for that, but your opinion about who they are. And I think that's my last question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I also want to add my sentiments to those of from my colleagues here that I think the presentations were thought-provoking, and these are some of the matters that we have been grappling with most of the time, as General Holomisa has said. My questions may be questions or comments. It depends on how they would be taken. First, I would just want to go back to the question of the of South Africa, the UN, and Zimbabwe. I just want to know whether I've been looking at the politics around that issue of Zimbabwe, looking at the recent Chinese arms debacle. The attitude of the UN, the US, and Britain, whether they're also preparing for a stage where they would invoke the Security Council international law on humanitarian interventions, that is 688, where they would then move in diplomatically and militarily. I think they are preparing for that, but I just want to hear your assessment of that. The other issue I want to go to is, which I think both presenters also raised, this thing of the experts or those who are in trial, whether it would be fruitful for them to also meet with the Portfolio Committee of Foreign Affairs. Because, as you said, they are dealing with the essence of the whole thrust and education of foreign policy and the equipment of our own diplomats. The third point is on public engagement. I also want to support the view that the DFA, DTA, I would like to add Labour and also AGISA stroke GIPSA. Particularly when it comes to the question of the African diaspora, because you seem to see parallel lines there. AGISA, stroke GIPSA, recruiting all over the world, but who are they recruiting? Sometimes they're recruiting people who ran away from here. Now they're coming back, you see, untransformed as they are. So. you need to synergize that and see what is the deputy president really recruiting. Who are those people? The African diaspora, those Africans out there, what is their situation? Is there no special program that we can... The other thing that was raised was about this coordination of the foreign policy, this trips of the legislature, provinces. I would like to see a point where this portfolio committee also would in fact summon the legislatures to come and discuss this issue of a foreign policy with them. There has been that lack where we think they should go and do their own thing. The other point is on South Africa and Africa. I agree with Nondaba that South Africa is the reluctant hegemon. I think it is the international system and the policies that you pursue that are going to shape the character of the state, whether you're going to become a hegemon or not. And South Africa is simply reluctant, but the system around it are shaping that character, whether we like it or not. At some point, we need to be aggressive. We need to adopt that character. But at the moment, as you say, we are reluctant. We are simply reluctant, actually. But we are going to be, whether we like it or not. The U.S. did not choose that. But immediately they chose the policies like international peace, democracy, and free market. then they found themselves having to pursue that and become the hegemon they are because of those policies safeguarding their own national interests at all. So I think we are going there, whether we like it or not. I agree with the team there about the clarity, the more coordinated and effective and more focused the policy of the foreign policy of the department at this point in time. I think a few years ago when we started, members will remember some years ago really it was very ad hoc. But now it is in fact a focus. No, let me just stop there. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
The new MP next to me, yeah?
The chap one is the email.
Oh, but for the email.
In the back. Yeah, in the email.
Dr. Zondi, let me firstly apologize that whatever that I might be raising might be a bit out of context in relation to what would have been your input when you talked to it. But it's interesting on page 21 your presentation. The question of return on investment, concomitant with our foreign policy, what is it that we're contributing outside of our shores? And what is it that we want to get back from those kind of contributions, the kind of funds that we tend to contribute to? Somewhere on your slides, you talked about the question of sub-imperialism. And as and when I saw this page, I immediately went back and thought about it. To what extent would that also not contribute to this already existing perception that South Africa is also gravitating towards being another imperial body? I bumped on one copy of New African Mail. It talked about the role that Cuba played in the liberation struggle of Africa. And a very interesting sentence that says, the Cubans did not only come to Africa, but they only came to liberate Africa and nothing else. When they left with their bodies. And the context of this input on page 21, to what extent can you say that as a country our role is to make sure that the democracies that are established worldwide, without having to then say what do we get out of that establishment? Because I personally think it will also be problematic. It will have a lot of elements of neocolonialism. When we then say this is what we're going to put in, but in return, these are aspects that we think we should be able to get. Of course, you can't run away from the fact that as and when you contribute, there are particular aspects that are principles that we want to deal with democracy and so on and so forth, elections and whatever it is. But to what extent does this concept of return on investment as well, from a foreign policy point of view, can also lead to this neo-colonial mentality that South Africa is developing to be a pariah, when in essence, conversely, the Cubans came here to liberate us and they left with their body back.
I want to raise the last point that has been raised, but from a different angle. Say that if you look at the role that South Africa played in a number of conflict resolution processes, classical example in the DRC, in the Kivu area, I think it's not Kivu, there's still problems there. We played a critical role in that aspect to bring the conflict and elections to where they are. And it appears that in fact the people, we are irrelevant. We are no more the force that was at the center of resolving the DRC conflict. It's the US has taken over. I want to ledge that on the concept that those who are in there now, they're in there for every 10. Is it correct for us to do the dirty work and get out with our gumboots, having spent money, labor, and everything else, only to have paved way for those who come and reap the benefits of our hard work? I'm raising that in contrast to what has been raised, so that we can look at both angles, whether it is correct at this particular historical period. Whether we should be doing that. But also raise the fact that if you look at
the
work we've done with Rwandese, when we're resolving the conflict, I mean, literally the Rwandese only left there because of our own work and our own influence. What semblance of influence do we have on Kagame today as a country? And what influence do we have on Kagame today? So I'm raising this to say, this return on investment, I'll also argue that we should not be motivated by return on investment. However, I'll say, is it correct for us to continue to do the spade work? In the Comoros, we put the situation back to where it was, and when there were problems, a decision was taken in Paris to move militarily. We objected, they went ahead nevertheless. And we're the core country that contributed troops that kept the processes in the commerce together. So the realities of international relations and the interests of states, these are the moral obligation that those who execute that policy have. How do you find the balance in that aspect? The other issue that related to that I thought presenters could have gone deeper into this, is what I would regard as the threat to our foreign policy or our foreign policy perspective. What is it that threatens our foreign policy? I see the weaknesses as you raised them, but what are the elements that threaten our foreign policy? I'm raising this leading also up with what has been raised earlier. When the China ship was turned back, you had South Africa saying different things at different times, and everybody saying that this was a good effort to have been made. But sitting where I'm sitting, I'm asking myself, who does it is, what does it mean to our foreign policy? Has that affected our foreign policy positively or negatively? If it's positive, what are the positive benefits for that? If it's negative, what are the negative elements? And that particular action, whether rightly or wrongly, and on whatever the reason, I'm not going to argue the reason of whether it was correct for Zimbabwe to have it, but I'll say that particular action, how does it impact on our foreign policy? Because I want to argue that our trade policies, particularly our international trade component, are influenced by our foreign policy. Now, I'm saying, if any country looks at us and say, if I trade with these countries, if I use their facilities, tomorrow I may not get my goods, where does it put us? How does it affect us? So I'm saying, is there an impact or there's no impact? To what extent will that particular action work for us positively or negatively? And I'm raising that in conjunction with the Zimbabwe situation, because I know that sometimes it raises emotional issues, but I'm saying, to what extent has that particular action, if it has to happen, affect our foreign policy? The other issue that we are raising quite interestingly is the link, probably going back to what you raised as a return on investment, Dr. Zondi, but Tim raised in a different phase. It's on your page 31, Dr. Zondi. Donald has interest too.
is our interest the return on investment? And what return are we looking at? Are we looking at the return that will be at the expense of the local people, or are we looking at the return that will not be at the expense of the local people? I'm linking that with what the Portfolio Committee has been doing. We have argued consistently on the conduct of South African companies in the continent. And in fact, the governing party ended up taking a view that says there must be a code of conduct. Because we have argued that we need to look at our conduct. And we argue that South Africans, in whatever outfit, they have an obligation to carry the moral basis of the country and transmit that in whatever activities that they get involved in internationally. And therefore, our business community is one key component of that foreign policy element that we need to take care of. And of course, it comes back to the issue of public diplomacy. To what extent do we engage our business people to understand our foreign policy? When we hosted them, they've raised it up, I think, on two occasions. The need for a forum where business people and foreign affairs ministers specifically could sit and outline the priorities of the country in that particular year, and so as to allow them that when they make their own decisions, they can look at what are the country's priorities and make those their own investment decisions, taking into account what is the country projecting itself to be. And I think that's one idea that we need to raise. I want to come back, Tim, to the issue of threat to the foreign policy. In your slide, you raise the fact the impact on domestic policy. To what extent the issues that you raise of domestic politics impact on international relations? The possibility of a threat of that inconsistency or consistency that may exist. To what extent do you think that impacts on the international community? I've read an article that was written by on the plane, I think on the business day this morning. He raises the fact that here at home, people are critical with President Zuma while the international community have accepted they've moved over. This is a domestic problem. The international community has moved on, and he argues that in fact the domestic critics are left behind. And he used the contrast to say that when Gordon Brown emerged in a meeting with President Zuma, it was all smiles, indicating the fact that they have moved from what position they held initially to where they are today. And he argues that the domestic critics are still left behind in that particular process. The question is therefore, to what extent does that constitute a threat in the South African foreign policy implementation if that particular aspect becomes an issue? If your domestic political players are not in sync with the movement and the developments as they have been. I agree with the issues you are raising about whether when you have requested 1 rand and you get 50 cents, what do you do about it? Last year we wrote a letter to Treasury and we requested a meeting with them to deal with this particular aspect, to say that the department requested an X amount and they were given an X amount. And they responded to us to say that they are unfortunately unable to commit themselves to that particular meeting. However, they are willing in future to come to any meeting. Because in their view, the process of what we see as Parliament as the final product actually has its own processes that starts with Ministers' Council and all those processes. So what we see as final figures is what has been agreed. Now, it places this committee in a difficulty because we come at the end of the loop. How do you suggest you should be able to interact with Treasury in terms of dealing with that? Because, yes, in foreign affairs, you always get the answer. We get the same answer. Treasury has refused. And that's the dead end. But how do you pursue that particular aspect. And I'm raising this because I do not want to do that in exclusion of other competing interests of the country. Because I'm in foreign affairs, therefore I become close up and only my department that I wanted to get whatever it is asked for. But I'm saying that how then do you pursue? Taking into account that the South African institutional arrangement is such that it's linked to line function. So once you move, you create an uneasiness in terms of the line function oversight that you need to do. Now how do you conceptualize that particular situation? Lastly is the South Africa's foreign policy implementers and role players. You have the Department of Foreign Affairs and you have the President setting foreign policy basically and the Department of Foreign Affairs implementing that the foreign policy. So I don't have a problem at that particular level because those are constitutional prescripts. If you read the constitution, it tells that the President sets up the foreign policy and they delegate that to the minister and forms non-function. But you have DTI, you have defense, and I'll raise just those two. And of course, you've got other departments, public service in the DRC or IEC and all those other agencies. But just deal with defense and DTI. When international engagements are engaged in, whether they be trade or defense related, to what extent do you assist not only as an administrative coordinator but as a content provider for these departments as a Department of Foreign Affairs? What's your view and your take on it? Because to me it's not just a question of coordinating. I will, for purposes of the issue I'm raising, I'll reduce coordinating to administrative backup. But I'm saying that there should be a content provision that the Department of Foreign Affairs has to provide these particular role players and to make sure that as they negotiate these entities, they should be able to deal with other areas of work that they are and may not be privy to. And I'm raising this, I'm looking at the Economic Partnership Agreement. I argue that the Economic Partnership Agreement goes beyond trade issues. They are a political instrument that the EU uses. That the EU uses to in fact regain both economic and political influence over the continent that they think they are losing. And therefore it means that our negotiators have to go out of the frame that is a trade issue. They have to now think of it as a political instrument over and above in being just a regulation of trading elements. And I do not see that happening. I see DTI still regarding it as purely a trade matter. And I say that the EU orientation has gone beyond it being a trade issue. It's a regaining of political and economic influence that they think the Asian economies have eroded. And therefore, I think that they need to go beyond that. And I'm raising that particularly looking at the particular aspect and looking at our own security engagement in the continent. Again, return on investment. You cannot deploy your boys at the front line and come back empty-handed and somebody else come and cut flowers and enjoy the garden that you've been looking after.
Looking
Tim, I want to come back to members on the second round. But I want to allow you presenters to present because I see that members want to make call up and some of those issues could be as a result of my comments.
I will work.
I'll buy a new watch. For now the watch is still in time. And because I'm the chair, I use my own watch. I'm using my own watch.
Stop.
Yeah, and I'm told that lunch is provided by the secretary, so if you can allow the presenters to go through the questions, then we'll come back. I'll see what I might have had the wrong watch, but I'm still on time. Mr. Rosenthal. thank you very much. It's impossible to answer all these questions. But how I find them useful for is to fulfill for our own better reflection on these kinds of issues, educating ourselves on what it is. The question I find very fundamental and the question that the country needs to discuss, and I think it's a question that the entire country needs to discuss, what is our interest? You know, generally the writings of Postcard thought classify interest into two. The old Greek philosophers would say the first interest is what they call supreme values. This is what the classical Athenian polity stood for. Peace among nations, goodwill, democracy today, you know, equality. Those are universal values, that are supreme values that bind everybody together. But then they said, there is an interest that distinguishes Athens from Sparta, from other states that exist. While they are joined by supreme interest, they are what is called ultimate interest. These are interests that are at the heart of the survival of the Athenian state, because it can't simply survive on the basis of supreme interest. Supreme interests are those that we use to actually relate to the other state. Actually, the idea was that there are no friendships, there are no friends. There are only convergence of interests at certain times, but those interests diverge at other times. That is something that will come very close to it now. That Nigeria under Obasanjo was our best friend. They helped us to really root this African Renaissance agenda and get the NAPAD off the ground. But when things changed for Obasanjo, when he realized that he needed to do certain things that are in the interest of Nigeria, that are in the interest of his party, PDP, what he then did is that he withdrew from the relationship very slowly, undercut us here and there. Two very classic cases. We have South African companies bidding for Nigerian Airways. That had close to collapse, and the South African country, South African company is granted that tender orally. But things turn around in a course of a week. They give it to Virgin Airways. And there's no explanation for that. The second classic case is that we work on Cote d'Ivoire, a very far off country, and we get the process moving very quickly. If I'm not mistaken, 2 weeks before we're to report to the UN, Obasanjo takes our responsibility from our hands in the glare of the public, so that it is Obasanjo and ECOWAS that report progress to the UN. We pushed the process. We had Pretoria 1 and Pretoria 2. There's agreement between Bagbo and the rebels. It gets there. When we got to the UN, South Africa is told there's an emergency meeting to discuss the Cote d'Ivoire so that we consult before we get to the UN. They are told there that ECOWAS has decided that South Africa has done a good job. They will take over from this point onward. So basically the point we're making, we've done the difficult task. The easier task of simply consolidating what has been said was then taken on. That's a friend, a very close friend, a very close strategic partner doing that. At the moment, our relationship with Nigeria is really collapsing, seriously collapsing. So what then I think that tells us is that we know what our supreme values are. We know what we want to achieve for Africa, and it's a common goal, I think. It's really good. But I think we have to reach just below that level to say, what is it that is that we would hide from everybody that is in our direct interest? I think that should not necessarily be parasitic, should not necessarily be bad, and you know, like the Americans would do simply just to benefit their interests at the expense of the others. It may well be that it is in our interest to actually prop up the population, even if that would undermine the dictatorships later on, if I may say that. It may well be that our interest is to secure the future of the citizens of those countries, themselves, even if it means it may undercut the governments that are in power, because governments are there for 5 to 10 years anyway. But the populations would last for the last time. Because I think our interest is in the populations and the citizens, the interest of the citizens, and not the governments that are in power. That would apply on Zimbabwe. That would apply on any other country. I think our interest, part of our interest, which is one of the obvious examples, is actually to export the South African example, to export what we have, so precious for the country, how to bring about a resolution of an impossible political problem through a negotiated settlement. I think for me that's a very clear interest. But when we go to the DRC and support a process that somebody else dictates, we then are actually supporting it on the basis of supreme interest. We want to bring peace there, but we're not supporting our interest, because our direct interest is to make sure that they have an inclusive political transition, which is in our interest. That is our direct interest, in my view. In the DRC, we supported a process that was actually driven by Belgium. Belgium wanted the current president in power and co-opt one or two or three people. That is their strategy. In other words, what they call stability, stability paradigm. We supported that without pushing our interest much more strongly, which is to say we want an inclusive process, we want to make sure that there is a clear process of transitional justice, we want to make sure that there is action-oriented government that comes to power, there is clarity of policies and programs. That's not too much to ask for the investment we make. For me, if we are able to do that, then we would have had secured our interest. I could say all sorts of things, it's very, very interesting. But my sense is that we instead of having a return for investment, we return with investment. In the DRC again, we don't actually really get fully what we want. We get peace, we get a peaceful transition, supreme value. But instead of our ultimate value, which is a particular kind of transition that we actually wanted, we don't get it. But we come back to prop up post-conflict reconstruction then. We have a lot of South African government departments that are in DRC right now. I was in the DRC last week. We have a lot of them. So we return with investment. We don't care what happened to the first investment. So if this collapse, we will return with investment. Not ask for a return or insist on a return on investment. So that is the same thing on commerce. We'll keep investing and keep investing and keep investing and all of that. And they also expect us to have an interest. It's amazing. They actually expect us to have a crude interest. That is why they accuse South Africa of trying to open the way for South African business. So they get surprised when they don't open the way for South African business. That's what the Congolese were telling. We expected that the South African companies would come and take over, especially in the southeastern part of the DRC, where there were new mineral deposits that were being there. They expected us to do it. They were quite very surprised when we didn't do it. And I think that is what also explains the challenge we have with the expansion of South African corporate. That sometimes it is indeed what South African corporates do when they're outside, but sometimes it is an expectation, almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. They expect these companies to be coming to exploit. They expect these companies to be coming, they expect these companies to further South African interest, but they actually do not. We get criticized for what we didn't do, which we should have done, actually. We get criticized for pushing our interest when we actually did not even. So that is it. Just briefly on what the threats to South Africa's foreign policy. I'm sure there is a lot. My biggest challenge, I think, for me is the increasing interest of the U.S. and the EU in the region. I'm not concerned about their supreme interests, their supreme values, that is good democratization and all of those things. I'm more concerned about their ultimate value, which is to completely change the geopolitical dynamics of the region. Because right now the region still can speak with a common voice It's one of the most unified regions when it goes to the UN, for example. SADC always has a common position. They are in a difficult position. They pushed the UN reform agenda. They got the whole continent to agree to the Ejumini consensus, which was done here in Swaziland. It's a problematic region. I think that, for me, is a problem. And Zimbabwe becomes a very good experiment over that, because the biggest fear is that if what Mugabe did in Zimbabwe is replicated in South Africa and in Namibia, then they would lose all the interest that they have. Remember, one of the biggest lessons we've heard from some of the biggest South African scholars about decolonization is that what happened is that the colonial powers were willing to give away power, but they were sure that they would maintain economic linkages so that they can continue to benefit economically, even if they don't rule politically. Yeah, that is it. And there's a number of them, but one that I think we need to think very carefully about is the fact that we have really survived and been able to do a lot of things, take our claim very seriously on the basis of our moral authority, the Mandela aura around us. But that aura is not permanent. We need to think carefully about how then we sustain the period after our prestige, when it becomes really a dog-eat-dog environment like everybody is, where it's about interest. I think we need to really think carefully about that. And then very lastly, on what was raised by Honorable Skosana earlier, I think it will be very interesting for the committee to interface with the brain of DFA, as Tim called it, because I think for two reasons. One, to understand what kind of brain exists within DFA, because as Tim said, in institutional terms, it's really improved very well. In terms of setting institution, administration, processes, and all, put very well. But I'm not sure if in policy and intellectual terms it has. Because if you look at what the brain is there at DFA, it's amazing. It's very, very small. And I get a sense that, you know, when there is not enough value placed on the internal intellectual combustion that would actually fortify policy value, the text of the policy internally. Part of the problem is that duty is ceded to the presidency, where you have the policy unit that is actually supposed to drive that combustion. But there too, it is not happening quite. And if we do not, if the interface with the brain may actually assist that small group of people, even to deepen their own understanding of what is happening, while at the same time should give the committee a very good picture of what would be our institutional memory going forward, because they are very critical for institutional memory, especially in policy terms. Because if the DFA is going to define what their interests are, what public diplomacy means, what do they defend? Because every donor has an interest that they defend, an agenda that they defend. It's called agenda, it's better that way. An agenda that they defend. If the DFA is going to clarify that, it's that brain that is supposed to do that. Thank you.
I'm aware it's past lunchtime, honourable members. The chair was correct, as ever. It's so much easier to write something down and and run away. It's so difficult, but so challenging to be asked these questions. This is the most challenging set of questions I've heard coming out of any committee, this is enormously rewarding. Should the presidency account to the committee? Absolutely yes. There's very clear constitutional guidelines about this. There are parliamentary guidelines, and no one is asking President Mbeki to come and account to the committee, but certainly with regard to the presidency qua institution. Absolutely. It's like denying that half of our foreign policy exists. We have to. It's something that's vital. It would strengthen the relationship, and I think it would be mutually good for both. I think it would be healthy for both. It's a surprise and it's a disappointment that since 1996, since the presidential review, under Vincent Lepay, the role of Frank Ciccani, that perhaps coordination has not been as strong as it could be. Ladies and gentlemen, honourable members, it's better than the disaster that could have happened to the two, but it needs to be improved. And I will want to get to that issue with regard to foreign affairs just now. Honourable Ceremony, DFA, DTI, Home Affairs, what sort of balance? I have the feeling that has been dependent on lack of identification institutionally about the roles and responsibilities of each. I think that goes to the relationship between the presidency, I have to say. I'm afraid it has to be said, but it's true analytically. The role of the presidency and the ministers and the DGs as well. That role has been somewhat inconsistent. There have been some very, what would you call it, blunt interventions. There's been a degree of reticence on the part of certain ministries to carry out their roles and responsibilities. And I feel that we are facing a potentially very fruitful opportunity in our country's history to look at the relationship between departments and between departments vertically and horizontally. But I think we need to move quite quickly on that. We have an opportunity to play into that over the next year or so. Honorable Skosana, you are more than astute in picking up on the talks in the corridors about the imposition or the attempts to impose or to assert or to flag or to activate responsibility to protect. The responsibility to protect maxim edict approach is being punted, if that's the word you would like to use, in the corridors of embassies in South Africa. It is being channeled back to embassies internationally, and it is finding its way into the channels and the corridors of the United Nations. With regard to Zimbabwe, yes. If things deteriorate or fall apart, or if violence intensifies, or if there's an unsatisfactory outcome, and I mean unsatisfactory constitution in Zimbabwe, procedurally, certainly that is gaining a degree of momentum. Whether it will be triggered, I don't know, given the current configuration of the Security Council, etc., etc. Should the committee meet with the FSR, PRAU, it's vital. I think my colleague, it's absolutely vital. It's vital for both. Vital for both parties. As far as recruiting Askisa, Gypsa, and who are we recruiting in the diaspora, it's an open question. What we do know is our skills shortage in South Africa is acute. It's been acknowledged by the President for 2 to 3 years. Askisa speaks to it. We need to recruit. But do we need to recruit people who, in fact, have left our country because they didn't subscribe to our values? I would say no. We don't need those people in South Africa. What we need to do is to strengthen our skills internally, and we need to recruit to those people who are looking for opportunities in the diaspora to come back home and make a contribution. Do we want recalcitrants, conservatives, racists, and fascists back in our country? No, under no circumstances. Should the committee consider summoning or dealing with the provincial legislatures as a matter of priority, in a convivial, collegial way, but as a matter of priority? That needs to be looked at, examined carefully. Roles and responsibilities need to be identified. I think the committee has got a very significant role to play in that. I won't go into the reluctant hegemon, but to come to the chair's positions with regard to what influence do we have and our roles and responsibilities and what have we inherited in the DRC. The DRC represents the new scramble for Africa. We are the ones that got it carried out in the body bags. We are the ones that put our necks on the line through the Renaissance Fund, through the negotiations at Sun City. We were the ones that paid for it. We were the ones that put our political capital on the line. We are the ones that took the lead, and we are the ones that galvanized international support for that, to our credit. We haven't come out empty-handed. We have a binational, and the binational seems to be working to some degree. It needs to be strengthened. We took, as you know, we took ministers, we took businesses, we've had our second meeting, and the president came back to, president of the DRC came back to South Africa, second leg of the binational, quite recently, a couple of months ago. However, I have to tell you, DRC is, particularly in the Kivus, is a complex, complicated conflagration, particularly in the Kivus, that is being made more complicated by the vested interests of the regional players, not South Africa. It's the regional players. And those regional players are not being held to account. And they continue to stoke particular interest and exploit particular interest for their own national interests. It is, frankly, it's more than a disgrace. It's something that needs to be brought to the attention of the international community.
Banditry.
It is banditry, Honourable. It's banditry at the expense of human beings. The last count, as you know, in terms of the conflict in the DRC, was up to 5 million people. This is a tragedy on an unparalleled scale in Africa in modern times. And it's happening under our noses after we have set in place a peaceful settlement. And the role that we even played in the post-election period, I think, was absolutely exemplary. And I'd like to pay credit to our former ambassador to the DRC in that respect as well. Regional powers need to, and that brings me to President Kagame, whom I will mention in passing. And the problem with Rwanda right now, one of the problems with Rwanda, is that it has, if you like, too many international options. It has too many international donors, too many, the United Nations, the donor community, the United States, regional players, but in particular the donor community, trying to put right through guilt what it failed to put right or to prevent in 1994. That has strengthened the hand of Paul Kagame. What influence do we have over Paul Kagame? Practically none, because the other players are very, very strong in Rwanda, particularly the United States. Some of the questions go to the profound issue about us, our self-interest, our national interest, and our broader interest. Honourable Sithole, if I may say, would it not be a valuable intervention for this committee to host, to conceptualise a national convention, a national meeting about our foreign policy, about its institutional linkages, its departmental linkages, its orientation, this tension between our commitment to human rights, to development, to the African agenda, and our commercial interests? I haven't seen it. I've seen the presidential reviews, I've seen the 15-year reviews, we have think tank meetings, etc. This committee could convene what could be an absolutely profound meeting or set of meetings over a couple of days that would bring together key policy players, key role players, business leaders, the presidency, DFA, DTI, defense, security, intelligence, etc. Let's just get some common understanding about where we are, even if we don't agree. Let's get some common understanding about this. And I think the committee could play an absolutely key role in that as well. The key threat to our foreign policy is that we have not yet understood or recognized what our interests are. We have no shared understanding, and that's the key threat, because our competitors do. They are very clear about what their interests are. We may not like them, but we have to admit that the interests of the EU are far better defined than ours. The interests of China are far more clearly defined than ours. The interests of the United States are far more clearly defined than ours. And that goes to our institutional, not overreach, but our institutional stretch. Look at all those key deliverables we sketched out earlier. This is a small department, 2,400 people, with a 30% shortage rate, the vacancy rate. It's a big ask. No wonder the EU out-negotiates us. I was in Brussels at the beginning of this year, and I went through every institution of the EU, every one of them, political, policy, advisory, development. It is a massive, massive, well-funded bureaucracy that is fundamentally political. Never mind it's economic, it is fundamentally political. At the top, right the way through, 40,000 bureaucrats, 40,000, protecting, promoting, and developing the interests of the EU. That's why it's powerful. It's not just because it's an economic bloc. It is a fundamentally political bloc. It is the largest political bloc in many respects on Earth, but it is much more coherent than we, and I agree with you. EPAs are not about economic development. They're not simply about the partnership agreements. They are fundamentally political, and of course they attempt to serve the interests of the EU as well. It's a fascinating question about the local perceptions and international perceptions without taking a lead from Sipho Sefi. Honourable Sithole, I think these things move, they are dynamic, they're reflexive, they are synthetic. When I was in Mexico, the EU, and Africa this year, all the trips that I've paid to Africa, EU, America this year, I have to say that the first question I came across or that was raised with me, and again not from Afro-pessimists, for example, or South African pessimists, was about the succession question in South Africa. It was a question. It was a give us some clarity. Where do you think it's going? Where are we going? What are you? So I don't regard it purely as pessimism or a dismissiveness of a particular figure against another. But I think the uncertainty is unnerving people, that they've had 10 years of certainty. I think they've clearly understood where we stand on issues. I think there's a genuine uncertainty. I think it does go to the issue about communication that Dr. Zondi wrote there. I would also say to you, without delving too much into personalities, that the personality you speak about, the president of the ANC, has certainly recovered international ground on a remarkable scale, which started, if you remember, the election was, let's say, December the 18th. If you go to Davos, from the position when the president of the ANC, Zuma, went to Davos, right the way through to his meeting with Gordon Brown, there is absolutely no doubt that he did the right thing in terms of the dynamics we're speaking about today. He went to opinion makers, he went to the international community, he went to the editors, the heads of state, he went to the business leadership, and he explained his case. And I think that's been successful. And I think the international community now feels more confident that it understands. It may not know the outcome, that we don't know the outcome, but it understands more clearly the person, the personality, and the dynamics. And this is something that the International Marketing Council, I think we need to look at the role of the International Marketing Council as well, as a committee. I would submit to you that the International Marketing Council, we do need to look at this role in Europe, the United States, and elsewhere as well. The difficult question about the oversight of budgets, it's a difficult question because of Parliament's role, etc., etc., but I would strongly urge the committee to try and find methodologies, modalities, points of intervention, points of access, far earlier than we see them now. We know that we now receive a bill, or we receive a budget, but we play or can play very little role, and in fact the same goes for the Department of Foreign Affairs. It's far too often implemented and far too little of the time it's spent on conceptualization. Honorable Sitoli, surely that would form an element of this national convention, this national meeting on the formulation of our policy, the role players, the rights, the responsibilities, and the roles of these. Could it not be formulated as part of that, how the budget is designed, what's negotiated, how it's negotiated? We're not going to change our constitution, but we can change the institutional relationship to create more transparency, more engagement, more stakeholder engagement, and I think this will strengthen the relationship too. I believe that Foreign Affairs has a wealth of talent that should still and could still be sewn back into and fed back into policy formulation. You know what happens. Missions send reports every Friday. Well, they should. Every Friday. They're on the ground. They have a wealth of information. Honorable members, let me share with you. I was in Tanzania a couple of weeks ago. I had a meeting with our High Commissioner, and let me place three things on record. I get to see our High Commissioner and our ambassadors almost without fail. Talk about battle clearly. Our missions are the most open missions on earth, in terms of receptiveness, in terms of discourse, engagement, etc. I find them remarkably supportive. Let me place something else on record. I was in the DRC a few weeks ago. My colleague fell quite seriously ill. We could not find a doctor. Within 2 hours, we couldn't find a doctor, but within 20 minutes of a phone call to our mission in Kinshasa, a political officer was at that hotel trying to sort things out for my colleague, straight away. Three, in terms of Bato Pili, the website has improved immensely, but I couldn't get the strategic plan to download. I contacted the Department of Foreign Affairs. I spoke to the webmaster. That document was with me within 10 minutes, and I get responses all the time. This is a department that's also being transformed in terms of its openness to people, and I think that needs to be put on record, and great credit to the committee for doing that as well. Sure, I think I'm finished with on that note, but thank you very much for your very challenging questions.
I want to thank you, and I want to apologize to members that competing with my watch might not be the best thing to do. I'm told that lunch is at V8, but I want to say, Tim, that, you know, on your suggestion, we hosted a meeting in Pretoria some years ago, where we brought in scholars to look at the South African foreign policy and whether it's implementable and the role of business in South African foreign policy. And I must say that from that, we concentrated on one aspect of continuously looking at the business role in foreign policy. Maybe we should go back to the broader concept.
It was when we started that meeting, it was a broader concept looking at the foreign policy as a whole. But we then zoomed into the role business plays in the foreign, in the implementation of foreign policy. And as I said, that culminated into what today people talk about as a possible code of conduct comes from those meetings. So maybe we need to go back to reconceptualize that particular meeting as we understood it from the beginning, and not only select one leg of it, but go back and let's look at the South African foreign policy. And possibly from there, seek to define what should be our core interests. Maybe 10 or 20 things that you could say, in whatever formation, and these are the core things that brings us together and that we need to defend. We could work on that. We could work on that. And I'm raising that openly so that both probably between yourself and Dr. Zondo could sit and brainstorm and see how we can pull that particular meeting together, because it will be an interesting engagement to bring as many diverse scholars as possible. And in fact, the first meeting, that's where the issue of hegemon was discussed. And in that meeting, it was debated whether South Africa is hegemonic or not, and a lot of people, I think Professor Habib was there, and he was insisting that we are hegemonic, and every scholar was there was saying, no, we are not. We are not the hegemon, and yeah, we left that debate as to whether we are or we are not, and left it open. And I hear today that we are now a new concept, reluctant hegemon. I mean, I started thinking about that debate to say, this debate has been coming now, there's a prefix to it, reluctant hegemon. But I want to invite yourselves to say, let's sit down and let's brainstorm about that particular idea, and let's see how we want to do it. I know that the staff has been very much at work when we're on holiday, and they've been communicating with me on emails. They've proposed that the committee host a workshop on South Africa-China policy. And I've said to them they must go on and work on it. And we'll come back to the committee with the final product. But we intend to host that particular workshop to look at South Africa and China. And they brought to my attention that we are 10 years in that diplomatic relationship, so how do we look at it? So I've said they must work on the document. I know that they are finalizing it very soon. It's a bit that Senzo is not here. But I know that he has drafted a document. I went through it. I made amendments. I've sent it back to them. So it's something that we have to come back to the committee. But those are the issues that the committee is starting to pick up to look at this particular relationship. There's an issue that I'll probably also raise it with yourselves that we want to embark on. It's an issue that relates to a debate on the African governance. We felt that we need to raise the debate to a different level. Parliament has debated it. We have debated it, but we thought that we should bring the intellectual community of this country at the highest level to look at this government, this union government. Let's look at the entity and let's draw the experiences from the EU. How do they bring together what we call today the EU, both at the economic and political level? How do they fit in a diverse political cultures into what today you see as an entity? In fact, what is interesting is that when we've been fighting with the EU, they said to us, if you had to negotiate with member states directly, you will never reach any consensus, because the dynamics within member states are very sharp and contradictory. The commission is a filter, it's a heartbeat of member states' interest. So the commission, as you say, that it's a political bureaucracy, it pulls all member states' interest, and then they consolidate them, and then they formulate one a political outlook, and that's what they run with. When they come back with a delivery to the member states, and they say, this is what we have delivered. If you're not happy, tough luck, but this is what we have. and the big member states who are behind the process, if they are happy, the whole 25 or 27 member states follow suit. The smaller states are not going to complain if the commission brings them more economic access. They are not going to complain. So as a result, the ideological outlook of the EU is actually the commission and the minister's council. Those are the people that actually shape the political outlook of the EU. And my problem is that that does not permeate to what is regarded as the partner, the ACP countries. We do not have that framework. We all engage the EU from our individual narrow country interest. And as a result, you don't sign the EPAS, your beef does not come in, your people are hungry, so you go there with your tail between your legs and you sign. Honorable member, let's go for lunch.
I'm